Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dory Smith.
The 22% of historic Palestine that was left over, 40% of that is controlled by settlements and settlers, or by the IDF defending the settlers.
While U.S.-facilitated peace talks between Israeli and Palestinian leaders remain stalled, a growing number of activists from around the world are personally visiting Palestine to observe or participate in the growing protest movement there. At stake are the illegal Israeli settlements and separation wall, plus a lack of access to Jerusalem, where many holy sites are now blocked off for both Jewish and Christian Palestinians. The Israel-Palestine Education and Action Group of Northeast Connecticut invited Chris Allen Dussault to discuss his recent visits to Palestine and Afghanistan.
I brought a few issues of our latest newsletter. On page 4 is a piece by our friend George Rishmawi. Some of you may have met George. He's a Palestinian Christian from Beit Sahor, who is one of the founders of the International Solidarity Movement. And by trade, he's a tour guide. But not very many folks are booking tours to the Holy Land through Palestinians. Most people do it through Israeli tour companies, unfortunately. And folks that go with an Israeli tour company don't typically meet Palestinians. So there are some opportunities to go to Palestine and Israel and see it from the bottom up rather than from the top down. And so please feel free to have a few issues here. People can take this and get a hold of George if you would like to go there. So my remarks on Palestine and Israel, entitling Cousins in the Land of Abraham, because we should remember Palestinians and Israelis are cousins in a sense. As Jews and as Muslims and also Christians, they all look to the prophet Abraham as their spiritual father. I'm a Catholic. Abraham is my spiritual father. He is buried here at the Tomb of the Patriarchs in Hebron, deep inside the West Bank. Side note, he was born in Iraq, in Ur, of ancient Chaldean city in the southern part of Iraq. I've been able to go to his birthplace. There's a ziggurat there that remarkably the Iraqis let you climb up on top of. But Abraham's land is disputed territory these days. But these pictures here are of Jews and of a Muslim, both praying, all of them praying at the Tomb of the Patriarchs, at Abraham's tomb in Hebron. And I open with this slide because Hebron, in a microcosm, shows the situation in Israel-Palestine of what's going on. It's all about the land. Those different colors represent who controls what land. After the Oslo Accords were signed, and people were all optimistic that peace was about to happen, that there was about to be a Palestinian state, what happened was different areas were created. Area A, Area B, Area C. Right? And so Area A is a place that was controlled by the Palestinians and administered also by the Palestinians. Area B is controlled by the Israelis, but it's administered by the Palestinians, right? But the final say is the Israelis, and the Israeli military is there, and Israeli authorities are there. And Area C is complete Israeli control. But if you look at the West Bank as a whole, you can see it a little bit more clearly about Areas A and Areas B, about who has control of what land. And I'm giving a large amount of background and context tonight. And forgive me if you know all of this, and perhaps you all do. But if you do, then credit to you for having, you know, done your homework. Most Americans don't know this context, don't know this background, because it's not given to us on the nightly news, and it's not typically printed in our newspapers, and it's certainly not taught in our schools. We're led to believe that this is somehow a religious conflict. And this is not a religious conflict. This is a colonial conflict. This is a conflict about land. Religion plays a role in it, for sure, mostly in terms of manipulating people, but this is a colonial conflict. Under the original UN proposed partition of Palestine from 1947, the proposed state of Israel would have encompassed 55% of historic Palestine when the British Mandate ended. Instead, the Palestinians refused to agree to the partition, right? And why would they agree to the partition? Why would they agree to give up 55% of their land? The Ottomans had been defeated. The British couldn't really manage it, and the British Empire was, you know, where the sun used to never set on it, the sun was getting ready to set on the empire at 5 o'clock promptly. And so the British were pulling out, and the Palestinians were going to get a state. They were going to get their own land. So why would they agree at the cusp of having their freedom to give away half of their land? And so they didn't agree to this. Unfortunately for them, there were large numbers of Jewish immigrants living there now who had fled the Holocaust, had fled pogroms in Eastern Europe. And so anti-Semitism can't be neglected or avoided in the roots of this conflict. And we'll come back to that. But also among the Jewish immigrants were paramilitary groups and some terrorist groups. And so when the Palestinians refused to agree to the partition, these paramilitary groups ended up seizing 78% of historic Palestine, and they declared the State of Israel. So if you're just talking in terms of the land, the State of Israel was declared on 78% of historic Palestine. If you want to identify, or at least I identify as, obstacles for a peace with justice, I mean, because you can have peace without justice, not going to be a lasting peace. But if you want a peace with justice in Israel and Palestine, these are the obstacles, I think. Right? The settlements in the West Bank, the status of Jerusalem, the return of refugees, security issues for Israelis and Palestinians. And I want us to pay a particular attention to number 5, to Christian Zionism. A very frightening and disturbing phenomena that very many Christians in our land are anonymous, perhaps, or unwitting Christian Zionists. It's a disturbing, disturbing thing. But first, settlements. According to the BBC, back in September of 2010, there are more than 430,000 Israeli settlers currently in the West Bank and in East Jerusalem. Right? About 500,000 settlers in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. These settlements, they're officially sanctioned by the government of Israel, and they control about 40% of the West Bank. All right, so the 22% of historic Palestine that was left over, 40% of that is controlled by settlements and settlers, or by the IDF defending the settlers. In addition, there are another 100 unauthorized settlements, often called outposts. Even the government of Israel doesn't agree to those outposts, but they are created usually by fundamentalist Jews trying to reclaim more land that they call Judea and Samaria, that they believe that it's historic Israel based on readings from the book of Genesis. And so they're going to claim that land. And there have actually been confrontations with the IDF removing some of these settlers from their outposts. Right? What they do is they end up parking an RV or a trailer home on a hilltop. And then it just begins from there, and it spreads down the hilltop, and then it ends up connecting to the next hilltop. My friends in Palestine, they no longer use the word settlement, by the way. They call them colonies, and they call the people living in them colonists. I think there's validity to that, to some having some clarity of language. The settlements are typically created on hilltops. Like this one is Har Homa, which is a settlement in Beit Zahor, just south of Jerusalem. The placement of the settlements is tactical, and it's related to water resources. All right. The settlements are created on these hilltops, and the wall is used, the so-called security wall, is used to connect them. The wall also serves to separate Palestinian villages from their land and from their water. You can see the ecological impact of these settlements. What was once a lush green hill, forest land, it's now a poured concrete compound. Water is a crucial issue. Amnesty International has identified Israel's water policies as contributing to human rights violations. Israelis, particularly urban Israelis, are using much more water than the USAID says you need, while Palestinians are using or have access to much less water. Israel, the way they're building their settlements and the wall, they're doing it in a way as to take control of the Maun Aquifer, up in the West Bank to take control of that water. Since its founding, Israel has chosen to pursue commercial agriculture growing bananas and citrus fruit, which is water intensive. Israel currently takes 80% of the water from the mountain aquifer, and the typical Israeli consumes twice the daily amount of water recommended by USAID. Meanwhile, Palestinians face rationing and dry taps every summer. Amnesty International and the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem have criticized Israel's water policy as violating the human rights of Palestinians by contributing to malnutrition and poor hygiene. One of the reasons the water is being taken is to try and recreate a Western European lifestyle in an arid region of the world in order to try and attract immigrants to Israel, and more specifically immigrants into the West Bank, because it's about the land, but it's also about demographics. It's about trying to outnumber Palestinians. And the birth rates of Palestinians versus Israelis is much different. Palestinians are making a lot more babies. And so one of the ways that Israel is trying to bolster their argument that this land is theirs is by having more people there. And one of the ways to get more people there is to attract folks from Western Europe by recreating a Western European standard of living with lawns and gardens and swimming pools in a land that can't support that type of water usage. My Palestinian friends like to stress that there are two types of settlers. One I already alluded to, religious settlers, like this man from Hebron. Many settlers have moved into the West Bank, what they call Judea and Samaria, claiming that God has given them the land, citing Genesis 15, verse 18. God made a covenant with Abram and said, "To your descendants I give you this land from the river of Egypt to the great river, the Euphrates." Religious settlers have disproportionate influence in Israel, in the Knesset. Because the style of government Israel has, it's not a two-party system, right? It's a multi-party system. No one party is ever able to gather enough votes in the Knesset to rule. So they have to cobble together a coalition. And the small religious parties that represent the interests of the settlers, they can make or break any government, a left-wing government or right-wing government. Without the settlers' support, the government won't stand. And so they're the quintessential swing voters, and they're catered to by the Knesset. My experience with religious settlers hasn't been a good one, frankly. The first stones I saw thrown in Israel-Palestine weren't thrown by Palestinian kids, though I've seen Palestinian kids throw plenty of stones at Israeli soldiers. The first stones I saw thrown were by the children of religious settlers in Hebron, who went down to the marketplace in the old city of Hebron and were throwing stones at elderly shopkeepers and overturning their tables. And the IDF was there protecting those kids from the anger of those market people who were having their stuff destroyed. One of the settlements in Hebron, Kiryat Arba, it's a very large settlement at this time, there is a memorial to an American, Dr. Baruch Goldstein, who, in that first slide I showed you, there were Jews praying inside the tomb of the patriarchs. Until Dr. Baruch Goldstein went in there in 1994, Jews hadn't been able to go and pray there because it was completely controlled by Palestinians, and it was just a mosque. Now it's a mosque and a temple, a synagogue. Dr. Goldstein went in during Ramadan prayers. There were 800 Muslims praying, and he threw a couple of hand grenades into the crowd, and then he opened fire on them, and he killed 29 people that were praying. And since that time, the IDF has taken control of the Tomb of the Patriarchs and divided it so that Palestinians can pray in one part and Israelis can pray in another part. So, but anyways, in Kiryat Arba, there's a memorial to this man. And we went to visit this settlement, and there were folks praying at this memorial to him. And when we interviewed them, they said, yeah, he's a hero. The other kind of settler are so-called economic settlers, folks that have moved to the settlements because it's subsidized by the state of Israel, which is subsidized by us, and they're able to get a bigger house and a nicer house because of the subsidies. And so it made economic sense for them to have a better life to move to the settlements. These folks, though, a lot of them moved to these settlements around the time of the Oslo Accords because they thought peace was about to happen. And I'm not quite sure how they imagined that it would work for them to be in settlements inside another country, and that would be a peaceful thing. But they're not driven by ideology. They're driven by, you know, a dream of a middle-class life or an upper-middle-class life. And actually, in my times there at some of the nonviolent demonstrations I've been at, folks from these settlements join in with the Palestinians demonstrating against the wall. They join in with the Palestinians getting tear gassed and beaten by the IDF. It's kind of odd, but great that they're showing some solidarity. Right? So they live in a settlement, which is at the crux of the problem, but they'll join in the demonstration against the wall, which is being built to connect all these settlements and take more land away from the Palestinians. It's curious, right? I mean, a more powerful act would be for them to maybe move out of the settlement. I was in Berlin. There were hundreds of Israelis demonstrating with us. Hundreds. The next stumbling block is Jerusalem, which Israel has declared to be its capital, and so far no country has recognized that. And a future Palestinian state would want to declare Jerusalem to be their capital as well. But that's going to be kind of difficult. And so the Palestinians want East Jerusalem to be their capital. And Israel is working very hard to change the demographics of Jerusalem in their favor to justify their claim as it being their capital and not the Palestinians' capital, or not a shared capital. Under the proposed partition in 1948, it was proposed that Jerusalem would be an international zone, that it wouldn't be Israeli or Palestinian, it would be an international city. That didn't work. And when Israel was founded, Jerusalem was controlled by the Kingdom of Jordan. And Israel didn't get control of Jerusalem until the 67 War. And now they're redrawing the boundaries of Jerusalem to change the demographics. They are evicting Palestinians from their homes. Some Palestinians were evicted when I was there. Some Palestinians, they try their best never to leave their home empty, because there are folks that will come in, Israelis that will come in and steal their home if it's empty. And then the IDF won't remove them from the home. It becomes their home. So I visited one place where this family, this elderly woman, is sleeping under a tarp in her front yard because an Israeli family stole her home. And it's just gone. Her home is gone. Right? And so this Israeli family, they walk by her every day when they go out the front door, and she's sleeping under a tarp in her front yard. The other thing that Israel is doing to change the demographics, aside from pushing Palestinians out by taking away their homes and by demolishing their homes, the wall is being built to go around Palestinian neighborhoods to put them on the outside of the municipal borders. And then the wall is going to encircle settlements to put them on the inside of the Jerusalem borders. So Jerusalem today extends almost to Bethlehem. And it's a way to make the numbers work, to have there be more Israelis living in Jerusalem than Palestinians. The problem of refugees is a huge stumbling block. And with Palestine's equivalent of the WikiLeaks documents, it looks like that Mahmoud Abbas was ready to give up on the Palestinians' right to return, which is an internationally recognized right. It's international law that refugees should be allowed to return to their home. That there were going to be refugees as a result of the founding of Israel was not a surprise to anybody. And it goes back to Lord Balfour from the Balfour Declaration. Let me read this. It's from something I wrote when I was at Yale. From the earliest discussions of creating a Jewish homeland in Palestine, it is apparent that little consideration was given to the Palestinian people who would be displaced. This sentiment is made plain in an August 11, 1919 memo from Lord Balfour to his successor in Britain's Foreign Office, Lord Curzon. Balfour wrote, "In Palestine, we do not propose to go through the form of consulting the wishes of the present inhabitants. The four great powers are committed to Zionism, be it right, wrong, good, or bad. Zionism is rooted in age-long tradition, in present needs, in future hopes of far profounder import than the desires and prejudices of the 700,000 Arabs who now inhabit that ancient land. So they predicted right off the bat that at least 700,000 people were going to be evicted from their homes, that people were going to be displaced, Palestinian Arabs were going to be displaced. But Lord Balfour refers to this reason of far greater import, right? He wasn't talking about the needs of Jews. The world wasn't too concerned about Jews at this time, if you remember. He was talking about, it wasn't yet called Christian Zionism, but it was the seeds of Christian Zionism. The future hope of far profounder import proclaimed by Lord Balfour in the quote I just read is the return of Jesus Christ at the end of time. The beginning of the 20th century saw an increase in literacy and an increased access to the Bible, which fostered a rise in restorationist theology. Think about it this way. For generations, people didn't read the Bible themselves because A, they were illiterate, and B, Bibles weren't available, and that's why you had a clergy. And that sounds awful and everything, but, and this isn't because I'm a Catholic, but there's a certain wisdom to that. And this is the wisdom. Where's David? David, imagine if we're in Sudan and we brought the sports page from the Boston Sunday Globe and we had it translated into Arabic and we gave it to one of those folks in a camp in the middle of Darfur and we asked them to read a story about last night's game that the Red Sox played in. And they can read because they're literate and they have the paper because we gave it to them. And so they read about these men stealing and going home and playing in the shadow of a green monster. Would they have any idea what was being talked about? You know? And it's a similar sort of thing. Christian Zionism, you know, Christian fundamentalism, comes out of that same sort of reading of the Bible, of not knowing the cultural, the historical, the political context in which it was written. And so this theology, this restorationist theology, is the forerunner of today's Christian Zionism, based on a literalist reading of Hebrew and Christian scripture, which concludes that Jesus Christ will not return to earth until the Jews have been restored to the Holy Land and the temple has been rebuilt. Right? The temple has been rebuilt. Well, right now there's the dome, the Al-Aqsa Mosque is there. And, you know, so these folks believe that the temple has to be rebuilt on that spot for Jesus to come back. Thus, the earliest modern expression of support for a Jewish homeland in Palestine by Gentiles was not primarily the result of concern for the well-being of Jews, but out of apocalyptic considerations. This guy here, John Hagee, I had the misfortune of reading a half a dozen of his books to learn more about his thinking. He's a disturbing man with undue influence, not so much in this administration, but a heck of a lot in the previous administration. You may recall during Israel's war against Hezbollah, which was really a war against civilians in Lebanon, that there was a lot of pressure on President Bush to pressure Israel into a ceasefire. This man met with Bush in the Oval Office and told him to do so would be to interfere with God's will. Because what was happening in Lebanon was a birth pang of the apocalypse, right? That we need to have this. We need to have this apocalypse happen, and it needs to happen there for Jesus to come back. And the president didn't need to worry, because the president, like a good Christian, was going to be raptured ahead of time. The good Christians of the world... And folks, I'm a Catholic, so I'm definitely not a good Christian, according to these folks. They're going to float away. The world's going to come to an end in Israel, in particular in Jerusalem on the Temple Mount. Jesus is going to come back. You know, they're going to have the four horsemen of the apocalypse, and everything's going to be okay. I know that sounds like crazy thinking, but that's the thinking of a whole lot of Christians in our country right now. If you get into any sort of conversation with many Christians about Israel, they're thinking two things. They're thinking, because of the Holocaust, we need to do something. And there's something to that. And we support it because that's where Jesus is going to come back. You know, Hagee is a supporter of Joseph Lieberman's. It's sort of twisted, right? Israel's more than happy to have his support. Joseph Lieberman's happy to have his support. And they all have different goals, right? but they're all using each other for the time being. If there's anything you can do is to disabuse people of this notion, that would be a good thing for world peace, because it's crazy. Christopher Hedges wrote a book about this that you might want to check out. I've been to a half a dozen war zones. I live in the north end of Hartford. I've been pistol whipped. Nobody has frightened me like these people have frightened me, because they have this vision that, nuclear apocalypse is good, it's necessary, and they're not going to suffer the consequences because they're going to be raptured away. That's some dangerous delusional thinking. I don't know if any of you saw the Left Behind series of books and movies. Those were wildly popular. A child actor from the 1980s, I forget, Kirk Cameron, starred in them. And that drew even more people into this. There's no other way to put it, I'm sorry if I'm offending anybody, but into this insane movement. Even some mainline Christian churches, there will be elements within those denominations that would be, identify with this. But there are probably some congregations where those people would be in the majority, and this nonsense would be preached from the pulpit in some mainline churches. Turn on, if you watch I don't, but, sometimes I'm sentenced to it when I'm at a doctor's office. I'll have the 700 Club on or something related to that. This message will be spread through the airwaves on those kinds of channels. I do want to recognize that there are folks working for peace there, Israeli and Palestinian folks working for peace. The Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, right? A wonderful group of folks, of Israelis, that surround Palestinian homes to prevent them from being destroyed. And if one is destroyed, they work to rebuild the home for the Palestinian people. So we don't want to lose sight of that. Rabbi Arik Asherman, originally from, I think, Pittsburgh, has been very active with the Committee Against House Demolitions, but also with Rabbis for Human Rights. A very, very good man. When I was there in 2001, he organized a group of internationals and Israelis to help harvest a wheat field for some Palestinians. The settlers that lived on the settlement up above this wheat field would light cats on fire and let them loose in the fields so that the harvest would be lost. And so we organized a bunch of Israelis and some internationals to harvest that wheat before that could happen again. Of course, the group I mentioned earlier, the International Solidarity Movement, which has been, it's 10 years old now, founded by Jews from Israel and Palestinians like Neda Golan and George Ishmawi, working to use nonviolent methods to resist the occupation, to resist the wall. There's growing sentiment. Mazen Kumsia's new book is about this, that there's not going to be a negotiated peace. That if the Palestinians are going to have any sort of justice, it's only going to come because of force, and that force, will be a nonviolent force, God willing. So again, I want to urge folks to pick up Mazen Kumsia's books. He writes very well about this. Mazen is a Palestinian American who taught at Yale for a number of years, and for the last few years, he's been living in Palestine, working on nonviolence, working on nonviolent solutions. Again, these two peoples, both having this strong claim to this land, right? And there's the idea that Jews from anywhere in the world can go and live in Israel. Well, that's a great thing. And maybe that actually could be a commonality for Palestinians, right? It's a similar principle of the right of return for Palestinian refugees. If you can recognize this principle that Jews who've been dislodged from this land for a millennia have a right to go back, then can't we also recognize that Palestinians that have been dislodged for a generation or two should also have a right to go back? It's the same principle. And that could be a point of hope, a point of commonality.
You've been listening to a talk by Chris Allen Dussault, co-founder of the Hartford Catholic Worker in Connecticut, about his 2011 trips to Palestine and Afghanistan. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program is produced in Storrs, Connecticut, and syndicated with Pacifica Network. TalkNationRadio.org for a list of stations airing the show and audio links to listen to previous broadcasts. Write to us at TalkNationRadio@gmail.com.